From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Tom Arnold says his private life has defied the old adage, there's no such thing as bad press. He got plenty of it when he was married to Roseanne and working on her show as a writer, actor, and producer, and he got even more when they divorced. Now that period is behind him, and he has an independent career in film and TV. He tells his own story in his new autobiography. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with him about his book, which is called How I Lost 5 Pounds in 6 Years. Tom Arnold isn't the only one struggling with a weight problem, although he's a lot funnier than most. We'll talk about the science of fat and why Americans are getting larger with Ellen Ruppel Shell, author of The Hungry Gene. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush has signed legislation creating the new Department of Homeland Security and naming the current Homeland Security Director Tom Ridge to head the new agency. The department will unite about 24 existing agencies, including the Coast Guard and the Immigration and Naturalization Service. The White House says it will take at least a year before the new organization is fully functional. Chief UN Weapons Inspector Hans Blix briefed the UN Security Council today on his latest trip to Baghdad as the first inspection team prepared to start work. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
As he came out of the closed-door consultations, Blix reconfirmed that the weapons inspections will get underway on Wednesday and is expecting Iraq to provide a detailed account of its weapons program by a December 8th deadline. He says the Iraqis continue to maintain they have no weapons of mass destruction and warns they'll have to provide convincing evidence of this.
They have their budgets, they have their archives, they have the reports of individuals. We do not. And if they want to be believed, they better come up with this.
According to Blix, Iraqi officials have raised concerns about the declaration. In a letter to the UN Secretary General, Iraq's foreign minister complained that any inaccurate statements could give the U.S. a pretext to go to war. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
The space shuttle Endeavour docked safely today at the International Space Station. The shuttle is delivering a new 3-member crew to the orbiting station and will take the current crew home after nearly 6 months in space. The shuttle astronauts will also install a $390 million segment to the station's frame. A new report from the FBI finds there was a surge in hate crimes against Muslims and people of Middle Eastern ethnicity last year following the September 11th attacks. NPR's Craig Windham reports.
The FBI said hate crimes against Muslims jumped from just 28 in 2000 to nearly 500 last year. And there was also an increase in hate crimes directed at people because of their national origin or ethnicity. The report cites the fallout from the terrorist attacks against the U.S. last year as a possible reason. Overall, the FBI says, hate crimes were up just over 17% last year. Of the crimes based on race, 2/3 were aimed at blacks. Of the crimes motivated by religious bias, more than half were directed at people who were Jewish. Anti-Islamic sentiment accounted for about 1 out of 4 of the religious bias hate crimes. Part of the overall rise in hate crimes is attributed to an increase in the number of law enforcement agencies voluntarily supplying data on such offenses to the FBI. Craig Windham, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials gained 44 points to close at 8,849 in heavy trading. The NASDAQ Composite Index gained 13 points to close at 1,481. This is NPR News. Officials in the former Soviet Republic of Turkmenistan say gunmen opened fire at a motorcade that normally carries the country's president to work. The leader of the Central Asian nation was not in the motorcade at the time. NPR's Lawrence Sheets reports from Moscow.
President Saparmurat Niyazov went on state TV to say he was already at work when assassins in a passing truck opened fire with machine guns on a column of vehicles in the capital Ashgabat. Niyazov said he was not made aware of the incident until later in the day. He blamed the alleged attack on political opponents. Niyazov runs the most repressive regime in the former Soviet Union. He tolerates no dissent and has been named president for life by Turkmenistan's rubber-stamp parliament. Niyazov enjoys one of the world's most bizarre personality cults. He's renamed cities, mosques, and even the month of January after himself. He's even penned his own pseudo-religion, which students are required to study. Several of Niyazov's former ministers have defected in recent months, calling for his overthrow. Lawrence Sheets, NPR News, Moscow.
Federal authorities in New York have charged three men with organizing an identity theft scheme that stole credit information from more than 30,000 people. U.S. Attorney James Comey said the case was the biggest identity theft in U.S. history. He said the case involved stealing the computer passwords and codes for obtaining consumer credit reports, which were then sold to criminals who withdrew money from the victims' bank accounts and made unauthorized charges on their credit cards. Prosecutors said the losses have reached at least $2.7 million. Many of the reports were stolen using passwords from the Ford Motor Credit Corporation. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, providing innovative approaches to food and facilities management services throughout North America. On the web at SodexoUSA.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Tom Arnold became famous the easy way, or the hard way, depending on how you look at it. He was having a pretty modest career as a stand-up comic when he teamed up with Roseanne, the comic and actress. He became her husband and a partner on her top-rated sitcom, working as an executive producer, writer, and actor. Their marriage was played out in the spotlight, and so was their 1994 divorce. Although the assumption was that he was riding on her coattails, she has pretty much dropped out of sight while he has maintained his movie and TV career. His films include Hero, True Lies, 9 Months, and Austin Powers, International Man of Mystery. He's co-starring with Arnold Schwarzenegger again in the forthcoming sequel to True Lies. And he hosts the Fox Sports Show, the best damn sports show, period. Now he has a new autobiography called How I Lost 5 Pounds in 6 Years. Food is just one of the things Arnold has found it hard to say no to, but he says he's been clean and sober since 1989. I asked him first about his relationship with Roseanne. Excuse me if this is a kind of odd question, but it seems that one of the things you both had in common was dysfunction, you know, being overweight, coming from troubled family backgrounds. And, of course, you were funny, too, so that's another thing you had in common. But I'm wondering if like, kind of shared dysfunction ended up being a good basis for a relationship?
Well, I think it is the basis to start a relationship, certainly. When we were friends, I met Roseanne when I was 23 and she was 30, and we both just started doing comedy. I lived in Minneapolis and she lived in Denver, and this was before she moved to L.A. And we had a lot in common because we liked to be crazy and have fun, and yet she sort of had this second life because she was a mother with 3 kids and a husband, and so she'd go back to that life, and I'd stay in Minneapolis and continue on doing all these crazy things. And when we got together in Los Angeles, I think that, you know, those things made it fun, the dysfunction and the craziness. But to keep a relationship going, you can't be too much alike. I think that was a problem for both of us.
In your book, you say that your personal life defied the adage, there's no such thing as bad press. And because you started your career, or at least the more public part of your career, with Roseanne, you were in the public eye in a very enormous way. So what are some of the ways you think you defied that adage that there's no such thing as bad press?
Well, I think that the way I got famous, everybody in my business, they dream of being famous and dream of being successful. And I got famous for being with somebody that was famous. I mean, that's not the way I would recommend being famous if you want to have a career, because it's hard to be taken seriously when the public knows you as, you know, this goofball that's with this very talented woman. The bad press, having, and I mentioned this in the book, and I don't know if it's appropriate to talk about, but having your ex-wife go on Saturday Night Live and say that you have a 3-inch penis is an example of maybe some press that you don't really want to, cultivate.
Right.
Right.
Say no more. During the early part of your career, I think there was some question about whether you were really talented or whether you were just riding Roseanne's coattails. Did you believe at that time, before you really had more of a track record of your own work, before you were in movies and you had your own specials and your own TV shows and stuff like that, did you believe that you had talent? Did you have real confidence in yourself?
No, I really didn't have confidence in myself. I'd always dreamed. My original dream was, when I lived in Iowa as a kid, I just wanted to be on television once so that the people that I grew up with would like me and say, wow, you know, look what he did. But I really didn't have any confidence. And Roseanne was the first person in my life that I respected that said, oh, you're really funny and you're really talented. And so what I did was I didn't believe it, but I thought, well, if she thinks it and I think she's pretty brilliant, then maybe it's true. And what happened was eventually by walking that walk, I started believing in myself a little bit. And so that is, you know, that's what's kept me going to this day is the confidence. And that's one of the gifts that I got from her.
One of your early movie roles was in True Lies, which was directed by James Cameron, who went on to direct Titanic and starred Arnold Schwarzenegger. Describe your role in this movie.
Well, this is an interesting part because at the time I got it, nobody wanted to hire me to be in a movie. And Jim Cameron just kind of on a fluke said he'd meet with me. And so I went in there and it kind of worked out. I was supposed to read some lines and I was so embarrassed to be there to waste his time that I didn't even pay attention to the script. And then he said, would you read these lines? And I was like, okay. And then he said, look, can I film you? And so I started thinking, well, this is kind of serious. So he filmed me and he said, I'm bringing Arnold in an hour. And I want you guys to be together, see how it goes. And he brought Arnold in and it worked very well. So, and then he said, don't tell anybody, but you got the role. So this great thing is happening to me and I'm not supposed to tell anybody, which is very hard for me. And of course I told people, but fortunately nobody believed it. But the Fox, the studio was against it. Everybody was against it because of, you know, I publicly had some problems in the press and had this tumultuous marriage and a lot of crazy stuff and had not done anything too incredibly well up to this point. So, but Jim Cameron said, he's the best guy for my movie. That's who I'm going with. And so I spent 7 months filming this movie. And at the same time, my marriage was collapsing. So in the summer of 94, I was going through a public divorce. My television show on CBS had been canceled. I had no jobs. The only thing I had was this film, True Lies, that was in the can, and people were saying, it's going to be great, it's going to be great. But by then, I couldn't believe that, and I just assumed I'd be going back to Iowa soon. And what happened was it came out, I think it was July 14th in 94, and people's perception of me, and the press's perception at least, went from this guy is a loser, he'll never work again, to, you know, he's pretty good in a movie, maybe he's a decent guy. So overnight, I mean, it changed things. And just by being good in this big hit movie, so it really saved whatever career I had. And, you know, since then, I've done things to hurt my career, but with decisions I made. But it still was, you know, it was a very career-saving event.
You titled your new autobiography, How I Lost 5 Pounds in 6 Years. Funny title. Were you heavy as a kid?
You know, I always thought I was fat as a kid. I never would take my shirt off. I always felt fat. But when I look at pictures of myself as a kid, I was pretty good shape. So, you know, it's funny as you're bigger and you're older and you look back and you remember feeling fat when you were younger and you think, why did I feel that way? What's wrong with me? I wish I would look like that now. So it's been something I've battled in adulthood a lot and do to this day, obviously, and I assume I'll always battle it.
When do you think you started really putting on weight?
Well, I put on weight in my 20s. I think when I was 20, I weighed 200 pounds. I remember that for the first time. And then when I was 30, I weighed 300 pounds. So I saw the progression of 10 pounds a year, and I kind of played that out in my head. Well, how soon till I get the record? I mean, if I'm 40 and I'm 400 and 50 and 500. So, you know, I got really disgustingly big. You know, I drank a lot. And ironically, I was also a cocaine addict. And a lot of times cocaine addicts tend to be the slimmer folks. But, you know, I could still eat and everything when I was doing the drugs. So it had no benefits whatsoever for me. And it got a little scary. And what I did was I went on a diet. I think Roseanne and I both did this, but Oprah had lost a whole bunch of weight, and I saw on TV by drinking this stuff called Optifast or whatever it was, and you don't eat any food, you just drink these shakes. So for about 65 days, I didn't eat any food, I just drank these shakes, and I lost over 80 pounds, and that was great, but, you know, I sort of lost my mind and, you know, immediately started gaining the weight back, and there's no, you know, I learned a pretty good lesson that there's no easy way out of this thing.
How did being heavy affect your sense of yourself as a performer?
Well, you know, being the fat guy, you know, it's a little bit easier in life to be a performer and be the fat guy, because people accept that. I mean, if you look at television today, look at the ABC or CBS schedule, you'll see a lot of fat guys with a lot of very pretty trim women. So I think that this business accepts that to a certain point, especially if you're the funny fat guy. But it affects the rest of your life in pretty interesting ways. I think that people you know, they accept it up to a point. But if you look like you're the fat guy that's going to have a heart attack, then people start getting concerned, and the audience doesn't appreciate that.
Are there like stupid fat roles that you turned down? Roles that struck you as really dumb that were based on like stupid fat jokes?
Well, there's a lot of roles like that in very stupid movies. And you know, I've been in some movies that weren't so good, but I fortunately have never had to go to that place where it's all about making fun of the fat guy. The worst thing I ever did, I gained 40 pounds to be in an Oliver Stone film. And
which one?
Any Given Sunday. Mm. And the story goes like this. I rehearsed with Al Pacino. I did all this stuff. I did this and that and this and that. And they changed the way my face looked. They did a lot of different things. And then I got a call that it wasn't working out. And then I went to see the movie, and Oliver Stone played my part. So, you know, it was a great opportunity to gain some weight and to, you know, to spend a little time with Oliver Stone and those guys. But, you know, it didn't pan out, which, you know, in some ways I write about in the book, but I was kind of relieved.
Why were you relieved?
Well, at the time, it seemed like it would be a pretty chaotic set to work on. I never felt like that Oliver was happy with me. And, you know, I feel like if I'm going to spend 3 months with somebody, that I'd kind of like to know that occasionally they felt I was doing the right thing. So I'm not sure if in the back of his mind he always said, well, I really kind of want to play this myself. But it wasn't that great of a part. You know, I mean, it would have been great to be in the film, you know, a big honor. But it wasn't a bunch of acting. I was playing a sportscaster. And so, but the funny thing is I put script notes as we were rehearsing. And he actually, when I went to see the film, he actually used some of them. Unless his ex-wife had 27 personalities, which it may very well be true.
My guest is actor Tom Arnold. He has a new autobiography called How I Lost 5 Pounds in 6 Years. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Tom Arnold is my guest. He has a new autobiography called How I Lost 5 Pounds in 6 Years. One of the things you talk about in your new autobiography is your family. And boy, this is interesting. You have, I think there were 7 kids in your family. One of your sisters is in prison. One of your brothers is born again. One of your brothers is gay. I have to say, this is a pretty wide range of...
yes, exactly.
Pretty wide range of personalities there.
Yeah, my sister, Lori, who is... I'm the oldest. She's the second oldest. She was arrested about 10 or 11 years ago for selling crystal meth back in Iowa, and I tried to help her out and got her a lawyer, but she ended up getting sentenced to 10 years in federal prison. It could have been 20 because she had a gun, so we felt, you know, when she was making her deals. So, you know, the family pulled together, and we, her son, we helped raise him. We sent him to military school, which was great for self-esteem, and did a lot of things. She got out of prison about a year ago with a whole new attitude, and I got her a job at the meatpacking plant, and she was going to stay sober. And I went down to visit her because I'd heard she was drinking and doing things which you aren't supposed to do if you're on parole. And so, you know, I had a little mini intervention with her, and she said, no, I got it under control, whatever. And then about 4 months later, I heard she was arrested again, so she's back in prison for 15 years now. Mm. So she was only out 1 year in a 25-year span.
How does your born-again brother get along with your gay brother? Does the born-again brother try to convert your gay brother to being straight?
No, and my gay brother doesn't try to convert him to being gay. It's pretty funny because my born-again brother, you know, I'm Jewish too, and so he's got, you know, he has some issues. He's a door-to-door kind of guy too. They go door-to-door and try to save people. But he accepts us, you know, as flawed as we are, he accepts us, and I'm not sure that his wife and his church group does, but we actually think it's pretty funny, and we try to torture him as much as possible.
When your parents divorced when you were young, it was your father who brought up the children, which was pretty unusual for the time. How did your father end up being the parent with custody?
My parents got divorced. They were going to court, fighting for custody of us, the judge, he got to the end of the trial, and the judge said, I have to put Tom on the stand. I was 4 years old, and basically he was going to ask me who I liked more to live with. And my mother was an alcoholic, and she had these troubles, and my dad said, well, that's it. You know, I'm not going to have my kid go on the stand. So after 3 months in court, my mother got us. The next day, she went to my dad's office and said, here's the keys to the house. The kids are there with the babysitter. They're all yours. So, you know, that decision that she made, although I was upset about it, you know, for a long time that she'd abandoned us, I was also very grateful because our life was so much better because we were raised by my dad.
Do you think that set the tone for a lot of your childhood, that mom didn't want the kids?
Yeah, oh, definitely. And it set the tone for my relationships with women, you know, later on in life. You know, the knowing that no matter what, but every 4 years a woman was going to leave your life, and that's I've never had a relationship that went 2 5-year, including with my mother, so that's something I'm working on very hard right now.
How long have you been married?
I've been married for 5 months.
Well, you got a ways to go, huh?
Exactly.
Tom Arnold is my guest. He has a new autobiography called How I Lost 5 Pounds in 6 Years. You say in your book that as a kid you were diagnosed with attention deficit hyperactive disorder and that you were given Ritalin. And I'm just really interested in hearing what it was like from your point of view to actually take Ritalin.
Well, I didn't like taking Ritalin as a kid because I, even though, you know, it was pretty chaotic in my head and I'm very hyper, I still am hyperactive, but I didn't like the way it made me feel. And I can, so I wouldn't willingly take it, and so my parents would put it in my food, and I can remember the feeling of eating a sandwich or eating some cereal, and then you sort of get a warm feeling in your brain, you know, and everything's kind of calming down, and I remember that feeling and thinking, oh no, they got me again, and you know, no matter what, I think you just kind of get used to the chaos when you're a kid, and you kind of use that extra energy to go about your life, and I didn't like being calm and just sitting there. I just wanted to be whoever I was, and my parents, you know, when you got 7 kids in the house, you know, you got to keep, yeah, you got to medicate the wild ones. So my brother and I were medicated, you know, whenever they could.
Do you feel like the hyperactivity of your childhood stuck with you as an adult?
Oh, yeah, I'm very hyper. In fact, before I got sober, I was back on Ritalin as an adult, and I remember thinking, wow, this is pretty good. I wonder if I could do cocaine. And, you know, I mean, so since in the last 13 years, I haven't taken anything, and I'm very hyper, and I just accept it and go with it. And it's a, you know, it's a positive thing, and if you're a performer, because you can always kind of get some energy. It's annoying to other people. Sometimes it's annoying to people that watch me on television. I do my best. I have my legs move a lot. And if I focus on my legs, then I sort of start pinching my face if I can control one thing. So what I figured out a long time ago is I'm just going to do my best at being myself. And if people accept me as that, then I'm home free. But there are things I can do. I mean, if I exercise in the morning, it cuts down. If I don't eat sugar, it cuts down. If I, you know, if abuse myself with sugar or certain food or by not exercising, then it gets, you know, it does get a little out of control.
Now, you mentioned you took Ritalin as an adult. I thought Ritalin is supposed to have the opposite effect on adults that it has on children, and that it would make you speedier and jumpier.
That's true with some people, but not with me. And that's probably one of the reasons I became a cocaine addict, is because it did give me a kind of a calm feeling.
The cocaine did?
Yeah, it did. And, you know, things like alcohol and other things, you know, I was so fired up. So still, those kind of things affect me different. If I have surgery and have to take pain pills, I cannot sleep, period. Hmm. I am up, and it still, it does affect some adults the way it affects children. It does stay with you a little bit.
So do you think that the cocaine habit you developed was almost a continuation of self-medication?
Oh, I'm sure it was. I started drinking when I was 14 pretty heavily, and I said to myself, well, I drink, but I'm never going to use drugs because those people are bad. And I never even smoked pot till I got out of high school and didn't really like that so much. But once I moved to Minneapolis, this woman gave me some cocaine, and I, of course, did it all. And I was like, wow, I got to get some more of that. So I went to draw out all my money. And, you know, this is a great thing. And the irony is the woman that gave me my first cocaine also took me to my first 12-step meeting, you know, as she got better. So, you know, I loved it. I mean, it made me feel powerful and interesting, and, you know, it took over my life completely. You know, I was obviously, by the end of it, I was going to die, but there was nothing I could do about it. But finally, and to her credit, Roseanne really saved my life in the way that she said, once I got out to L.A., I can't live like this. Because I was lying. I was saying, I'm not, you know, I just don't sleep, I would say. You know, it's my allergies. But finally, she said, that's it. And that helped me because then I knew I was going to lose her. I was going to lose everything in my life. And that was my bottom. And so I got in a cab and went to rehab and have been sober since.
Tom Arnold will be back in the second half of the show. His new autobiography is called How I Lost 5 Pounds in 6 Years. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Book Magazine. In the current issue, editors pick their best of 2002, books, titles, and characters, in bookstores or at 800-317-2665. And Find Law, offering an online directory of more than 1 million attorneys, plus consumer and business legal guides, providing a place to find answers, find lawyers, find law. FINDLAW.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, more with actor Tom Arnold, and we talk about the science of fat and why Americans have gotten heavier with Ellen Ruppel Shell, author of The Hungry Gene.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with comic and actor Tom Arnold. He's currently hosting the Fox Sports show called The Best Damn Sports Show, period. His new autobiography is called How I Lost 5 Pounds in 6 Years. When you started doing comedy, you were doing stand-up for a while. What was your act like, and did you have a persona on stage?
When I first started comedy, I'd seen a comedian named Joel Hodgson, who was out of Minneapolis, and he had props.
Is that Mystery Science Theater guy?
Yeah. He was great. He had props, and he was very dry and very smart. And I saw him at the University of Iowa, and he stayed at my house, and I said, oh, okay, what do I do to become a comic? And he says, well, you have to have a persona. And I was like, okay. And he left town, and I thought, that's my persona. I'll be Joel Hodgson. He's funny. So I started being very dry, and I moved to Minneapolis, and I had these goldfish, and they did tricks and stunts, and I'd pull a goldfish bowl out on stage and get them out, and one did an impression of the Pope, and one was a sword swallower, and one rode a motorcycle through a ring of fire. And it was silly, but it was, you know, I was the goldfish guy, plus I was Joel Hodgson. So I remember Joel came and watched my show, and and afterwards, I said, what do you think? And he said, you know, it looks very familiar. And I thought that, well, that's a great compliment. But what he was saying was, you know, you can't be me. Plus, I wasn't, you know, half as good as him. So what happened before I left Minneapolis those 5 years is, you know, I kind of got rid of the goldfish thing. And then I just started being myself, which at the time was kind of the wild, crazy, sweaty guy because of my problems. But it felt good to just go up on stage as myself and be at least marginally accepted.
You're one of those people who always wanted to be famous and to be on TV and all that. So how do you like being famous?
Well, I like a lot of things about it. I think you know, I've always joked, you know, I'd love to be the governor of Iowa. And my wife was like, no, you wouldn't, because then you'd have to go out. You'd have to meet people. You'd have to shake hands. You know, I mean, I like...
And you'd have to be the governor.
Exactly.
It'd be a lot of work to do.
Exactly. So, but I like... It's great because, in a lot of ways, because, you know, of the simple things, you know, it's easier at airports. It's easier at restaurants. You get a, you know, cool stuff. But you do give up part of your soul. The greatest part is when a little kid comes up and they're shaking and they're so happy to meet you, and that's so real, and that's the best feeling ever because, you know, that's the kind of kid I was. The worst part is that everybody has an opinion about you, whether they know you or not. And, you know, I opened up this book about Saturday Night Live, which I was so excited to get, that Tom Shales and this other fellow wrote. And so I look in the, you know, I look in the back and I see Tom Arnold's quote. There's something about me in there. So I start reading, and it was devastating because it was Will Ferrell, who I really like, talking about who the worst host ever was. And he said Chevy Chase, but the close second was me. It was horrible. And he's not wrong. It was horrible the last time I did it. But you know, that like, it took me about an hour and a half to get over that funk. I just laid in bed after that, but that's a problem. Yeah, too, you just have to be prepared. You're the punchline of jokes sometimes, and that goes along with it.
So when you read that Will Ferrell said that you were the second worst guest host, and it devastated you for, you know, you say about an hour and a half. So, I mean, how do you bounce back after that? Like, what do you tell yourself? What do you do?
Well, the process I used for this particular thing was that I said, well, I was terrible that week. B, I was unfocused. My second wife, between sketches, punched me in the face because she saw an ex-girlfriend in the audience. It was a tough week. And then I go to the fact that, you know, I've seen Saturday Night Live be not funny a couple other times. And I think Will has probably been in a couple sketches that weren't so funny. Then I got to pull it back because now I'm starting to get bitter.
Right.
So, you know, and I just think, yeah, that's really true. I was, it wasn't good, and I'm sorry.
Is that bitter thing an issue?
I try to not get bitter. Every once in a while, I could feel myself going that way, and then I just have to go, wait a minute. 20 years ago, I worked at a meatpacking plant, you know. My grandpa worked there 50 years. That could have been me. You know, I've been so lucky. You know, screw it. I got to not feel bitter.
So not that it's any of my business, but had you invited your old girlfriend to be in the audience that night?
No, actually, she was my assistant. I write about her, my old assistant, when I was with Roseanne, and we actually dated a little bit, and that's in the book. And she had a friend that worked for Saturday Night Live from the times that we used to go out there. But in all honesty, I wasn't aware she was there, but I had not said don't let her in either. So, you know, I deserved a little bit of a punishment.
It must be somewhere between embarrassing and really devastating when something really personal happens in a professional setting, like your wife pops you in the nose in the middle of a broadcast.
It is embarrassing.
I mean, like, you know, when problems in a personal life kind of show up in the professional setting.
Yeah, problems in personal life. When I was married to Roseanne and we were running the Roseanne show, you know, we used to have some pretty interesting arguments in front of people. Now, the problem with us was we didn't care. And I think it terrified people around us. And then we'd get over it and hug and it'd be all fine. But the people around us were like in shock. I think the most embarrassing moment was I was doing my show and somebody came up to hand me what I thought were new script pages. And so I started to integrate them and I realized this is somebody's filed for divorce here. It's a petition during the middle of the show in front of the audience. And there was another thing she did once. She did take my script and she had some people rewrite it and put it into the script and hand it to me. So I'm in the middle of the show, and I realize there's all these terrible things about me, and there's terrible things about Arnold Schwarzenegger, and these terrible things. So she was so devious that day that she took the time to get all her writers together and rewrite my script, which I wish they would have made it funnier, and just have these mean things in it, and they passed out that copy to all the actors on the show. That was embarrassing.
What did it say?
Oh, just just that I was a horrible, abusive person with a very small penis.
How would you compare what you think of as your stage persona with who you are?
I don't think I'm quite as goofy or quite as in real life as I am in front of the camera or on stage. I think I'm, you know, I could be a little more crabby in real life. I get a little more depressed occasionally in real life. I'm not as hyper in real life, so... You know, I think that when you perform, you just amp certain things about yourself up and, you know, when needed. And, you know, I'm more boring. I love to sit at home. You know, I'd sit at home every night if I could and just sit there with my wife or sit in my office and smoke cigars. And that's about all the excitement I need.
Tom Arnold, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Tom Arnold's new book is called How I Lost 5 Pounds in 6 Years. Coming up, the new science of obesity. This is Fresh Air. Obesity has become a health crisis in America. It was a year ago that the Surgeon General announced that 34% of Americans are overweight and an additional 27% are obese. My guest, Ellen Ruppel-Schell, is a science journalist who has written a new book called The Hungry Gene, The Science of Fat and the Future of Thin. She says this new science liberates overweight from the murky category of character flaw to the more potent status of disease. Schell is a correspondent for the Atlantic Monthly and has written about science and medicine for the New York Times Magazine, Smithsonian, and Discover. She co-directs the Knight Center for Science Journalism at Boston University. I asked her why she wanted to write a book about the science of appetite and weight gain.
I write about science for a living, and a few years ago I was grappling with the idea of writing a book on the genetic revolution and how it was going to transform our concept of disease. So I decided to focus on one company. And the company I hit upon was in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I began with a series of interviews there, and eventually I came to the company's top executive. And we sort of sat there and talked and talked, and he kept telling me how his company was going to revolutionize the treatment of disease, all sorts of highfalutin things, like how they were going to design finely tuned weapons to search out and eradicate heart disease and cancer and other killers. And I'd heard all this stuff before from other people and other big shots in other industries, and I found it very, very unconvincing. So finally I broke in and asked him point blank, if there was one disease he could cure, what disease would that be? And he turned to me, and his answer was not the one I expected at all. I thought he would say, well, heart disease or cancer. But he said, obesity. Obesity is the trillion-dollar disease. So that, of course, knocked me for a loop, because before then I hadn't really thought of obesity as a disease. But I did a little research, and I found out that obesity was indeed a disease. In fact, it was a plague. It was a pandemic that was kind of involving the entire planet. And so this book was kind of an adventure for me. It was a way to get at the whys of that question, which turned out to be very interesting and much more complicated than I had ever imagined it would be.
Let's talk a little bit about appetite and why we often eat far more than we need or far more than we're even hungry for. Apparently we have a tendency, I mean, we're almost designed to have a tendency to overeat. And the mechanism that tells us to eat is stronger than the mechanism that tells us to stop eating. Can you describe the science of that?
This is something that has long been thought, but it was not until, the 1970s or so that we really started to get a grip on what these factors might be in the brain. And at that time, there was a scientist named Doug Coleman, who was looking at mice. He worked at a laboratory in Maine. And at this laboratory, they have what I guess you could call a living library of mice. They have about 2,500 strains of mice. And these mice are used as a model to study human disease. And there are a lot of very strange mice there. Some of them are without fur, and some of them have no sight, and they have all different kinds of problems and mutations. And among these mice at the time in the late 1960s when Doug Coleman arrived at Jackson Laboratory was an obese mouse, a very obese mouse, and no one knew why it was quite as obese as it was. It was just enormous, about four times the size of a normal mouse. So Doug Coleman decided to apply himself to this problem, and he did some very, very interesting experiments. Probably the most dramatic of which was what you call parabiosis. That is that he slit a mouse, an obese mouse, from stem to stern, essentially, and sewed it to a normal mouse so they could share a blood supply. And what he found from this was that when he did this, the obese mouse grew thinner. And he surmised that there must be something in normal mice that was allowing them to hear their appetite signals that was missing in the obese mouse. And so it wasn't until the mid-1990s that at Rockefeller University, another team made the discovery. And they not only found the gene that made these mice obese, the obese gene, but they found the product that this mutant mice did not make that normal mice do make, and that's called leptin. A few years later, the obese gene was also found in humans. A pair of cousins from Pakistan who were living in London at the time. And these two cousins were incredibly fat. There was one that was 2 and one that was 9. The 9-year-old weighed about 190 pounds and couldn't walk. She was very, very handicapped. And it took some time to determine that, in fact, these two cousins also had the OB mutation. And when this was discovered, the scientist involved injected one of these children, the older child, with leptin, and lo and behold, over a period of years, her obesity has declined dramatically.
So these two cousins weren't manufacturing leptin or weren't manufacturing a sufficient amount of it?
In this case, in these two cousins, and this is true of about 24 people around the world, they manufactured no leptin whatsoever.
Do we know exactly what leptin does?
Yes, and this is where the brain comes in. Leptin signals the brain that we are full. It's produced in the fat cells. It's the first hormone that was found that was produced in fat cells. And it goes back to the brain to tell the brain to stop eating. Now, these two cousins had none of it, so they never stopped eating. Whatever their parents did, there was no stopping them. And what was interesting about this was that this was a proof of concept. While very few of us have the obese gene, what this showed was that obesity is directed by the genes, and some of us have it, there are about 200 genes that are involved in regulating the appetite, and depending on what constellation of genes we have, our appetite will be greater or less in a given environment. So this was proof of concept. This was 1997, and when this discovery was made in England, it galvanized the field of obesity and got many, many scientists all over the world very interested in it.
I think leptin has proven not to be the quick fix that scientists initially thought it might be.
That's absolutely correct. Leptin itself was not the quick fix. It was, at the time, the holy grail. You know, people were saying, wow, this is the answer. It turned out not to be the answer, not leptin itself. For most people, injecting more leptin will not help. In fact, obese people have more fat cells, and therefore they produce more leptin than average people. So injecting more is unlikely to really help them. But what this showed us was that there was a regulatory mechanism in the brain that varied with our genetics that could, to some degree, cause us to be obese or overweight or not.
Now, leptin, which signals us that we've eaten enough and we should stop eating, is it easy to say, well, I'm going to ignore that, what that leptin is telling me, because I like the taste of food and I want to eat it some more? Can you override that signal pretty easily?
That's a very good question. And scientists are looking at various signals. Leptin is only one signal. There are other things. For example, some people might have heard of ghrelin. It's another hormone that was discovered more recently that also is involved in appetite regulation. What we now know is there are a number of hormones and peptides in the brain and in the blood that are involved in appetite regulation. And yes, these signals can be overridden, but it's harder for some of us than for others to either override those signals or ignore those signals.
Now, you mentioned ghrelin. This is a hormone that makes people hungry?
This is a hormone that makes people hungry, yes.
And I think you describe in your book that people who have given injections of ghrelin are voraciously hungry.
That's correct, yes.
So are scientists tinkering with ghrelin now to see if they can, by adjusting ghrelin, adjust somebody's urge to eat?
Yes, what's interesting, though, perhaps even more interesting, is that what we eat can adjust these levels of hormones. For example, by eating carbohydrates, we increase the level of insulin in our blood, and surprisingly, this increases levels of leptin and decreases levels of ghrelin, and that actually helps us naturally control our appetite. So whereas some people think, well, gee, eating carbohydrates is bad because it raises our insulin levels and that makes us hungry, in fact, what most scientists really think is that this normal raising of glucose in the blood is helpful for the control of appetite. It's a natural thing.
That's interesting, because you hear a lot about being addicted to carbohydrates now. And what you're saying would really contradict that.
Well, not quite, because we now consume so many carbohydrates, especially in the form of sweeteners. High fructose corn syrup, which in the 1970s became more and more ubiquitous in the food supply, has become so cheap that we're now consuming more of it than ever before. And so we are awash in consumption of sweeteners and simple carbohydrates. And so, in fact, that is very definitely a problem and a concern. So when you overeat to that extent, the effect is beyond what would be normal.
Just to explain, high fructose corn syrup is a sweetener made from corn, and it's in so many processed foods, even processed foods that you wouldn't think of as being particularly sweet, like breads. And so explain a little more of the difference between, say, eating a lot of pasta and eating a lot of high fructose sweetened carbohydrates.
The thing about high fructose corn syrup or fructose itself is that scientists think that in fact fructose, as opposed to other carbohydrates, may be muting the leptin signal. Okay, so that we may not be hearing, when we consume large quantities of this particular product, we may not be hearing the signal that our leptin is trying to give our brains. So it's apparently quite easy to overeat foods containing a high fructose corn syrup.
My guest is science journalist Ellen Ruppel-Shell, author of the new book, The Hungry Gene. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Ellen Ruppel-Shell is my guest. She's a science journalist and author of the new book, The Hungry Gene, The Science of Fat and the Future of Thin. Let's look at some of the drugs that are either on the market or in development now that are designed to help with weight gain. First, let's look at one of the more old-fashioned ones, which is amphetamines. People basically used to take amphetamines as diet drugs. What was the principle there?
Well, the principle there was that it would speed up people's metabolic rate. And unfortunately, it came with a whole host of side effects that ranged from nervousness and sleeplessness to psychosis. So the use of amphetamines, which were very popular in the 60s and 70s for all sorts of things, not just weight loss, is no longer recommended, of course, for weight control. But since then, there have been a couple of drugs that have been approved by the Food and Drug Administration for use for obesity treatment. One is brand named Meridia, and one is brand named Xenical. Neither of these drugs has proved very effective for weight control for most people. Although people can show maybe a 10% weight loss over a period of 6 months, the weight, generally speaking, does gradually come back. Now, some people don't gain the weight back, but generally speaking, it does come back. So at this point in time, there really is no recommended or any, in fact, any medication that's on the market that has been proven safe and effective, and I emphasize the word effective, for long-term weight control.
There's also something called ephedra, which is sold over-the-counter. What is the premise of that, and what do doctors have to say about it?
Well, ephedra is sold in various forms in health food stores and drug stores, and people might have seen signs for it just along the road, you know, put up on telephone poles. Metabolife is a common brand name for an ephedrine caffeine mixture. Doctors have been concerned about the use of ephedra. It's not a prescribed drug. It's not well controlled. And recently, Congress has asked that use of ephedra be very much looked into because there have been many complaints to the FDA of side effects that went unreported for some time. This is actually quite recent that this concern was raised, although we've always, you know, scientists have always been concerned about the use of ephedra by such a wide number of people in the population. The combination of ephedra and caffeine, which people think is the most effective combination for weight control. And again, it's not particularly effective, but it certainly is widespread and it has helped some people lose some weight. But that combination has been implicated in raising high blood pressure, which, as you probably know, is one of the side effects of obesity. So any drug that raises high blood pressure, or any substance, I should say, that raises high blood pressure is probably not something to be recommended to most people with weight problems.
Is there any way of generalizing about how much of America's obesity problem has to do with genetics and how much of it is just a question of the foods that we're eating and the lack of exercise we're getting?
Okay, it's impossible to separate genes from environment. Our genes don't exist in a vacuum. They exist in an environment. And all of us are, to some degree, vulnerable to becoming overweight in any given environment. And as our environment becomes increasingly obesogenic, more and more of us will become overweight because our genes will no longer protect us from overeating. And that's what's happened in the United States. We become so sedentary and our food supply has become so concentrated in terms of energy and fat that it's becoming difficult for more and more of us to regulate our weight. So again, this is not really a matter of willpower. This is not something that we can say, well, you know, you have no willpower and I don't. If you find yourself to be slim in this environment, you're just lucky. People who are obese are less lucky. They have genes that make it more difficult for them to regulate their weight in this environment. So what I'm hoping we can do as a society is to deal with obesity as a societal issue. When you have 30% of a population with a disorder, it no longer really comes down to individual behavior. It comes down to some societal changes. So I like to compare this, for example, to tobacco. We really need to consider our priorities and consider whether big food like big tobacco should be given the first priority or whether we as a society need to reconsider and give human individuals the first priority.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Ellen Ruppelschell is the author of The Hungry Gene, The Science of Fat and the Future of Thin. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a 1945 recording by the pianist and singer Hatta Brooks, who was nicknamed Queen of the Boogie. She died Thursday at the age of 86. This was her first recording, Swinging the Boogie. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Delacorte Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Cloud of Sparrows, a debut novel of 19th century Japan by Takashi Matsuoka, and Nonesuch Records and Travelogue, the new album by Joni Mitchell, a 2-CD set featuring new recordings of 22 songs spanning her entire career, accompanied by full orchestra. Available at Barnes & Noble. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, Robin Wright, chief diplomatic correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. She's just returned from northern Iraq, where the Kurdish leaders are trying to figure out their role if there is a war. Wright was also in Iran, where she witnessed the new student movement that is protesting against the extremist clergy. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.